Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, the Mona Lisa Sacrifice coming out through Poplar Press. Peter Derbyshire joins me on the program to discuss it. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. So this is billed as the first in the Cross series, and it does end on kind of a cliffhanger. Did you conceive of it as the beginning of a series when you first started writing?
You know, not when I first started writing the book, but by the time I was done it, I knew I wanted to write more. It was sort of a one-off, and I fell in love with the character, with the world, you know, and I just wanted to go back and keep revisiting all those characters that I'd written, all those crazy settings, and explore more of their stories. So yeah, we're up to three books published now, and then a new one coming out in 2026, I think, and a short story collection as well that I've written.
So when you come up with a character like this, is it just that you can't let them go? Like there's something about them that you're like, I want to return to this person that I've created?
Yeah, I think it's more they can't let me go. I keep sort of wandering off and writing other things, and they keep pulling me back in. You know, the nice thing is with an immortal character, Cross is an immortal rogue. He's sort of been around since he's the sort of immortal soul that woke up in the body of Christ after Christ's soul left and after the crucifixion. So he's inherited this body with magical powers, but he's this rogue. But he can die, but he can't stay dead. Essentially, the body keeps resurrecting him. So there's just endless story possibilities. And so I'd written, the first one is largely set in the present day, the Mona Lisa Sacrifice, but there's a ton of flashbacks, sort of, you know, a lot of the stories told through flashbacks and his past and the sort of secrets of his past. And the Dead Hamlets, the second one is kind of similar. And the Apocalypse arc, the third one goes through a lot of the past and then comes into the present day. But because he's lived so long, there's just so many opportunities to go in and even tell one-offs with a short story collection. That's what I did. I just had like little ideas that I was like, these aren't really novel ideas, but they're kind of, they'd be a fun story. And so I had like a Prohibition Cross story and a Cross in the heart of the Grendel Beowulf myth story and, you know, Wild West Cross and things like that. So I just like the character so much. And because of his peculiar nature, it's really easy for me to sort of fit him into ideas that sort of pop into my head from different times and in different settings.
Yeah, he's kind of your Zelig.
Yeah, it's probably a nice way of putting it, maybe.
So you in the author's note for the edition that I read, you write, you know, in the beginning was a vague idea. You'd read an article about the Shroud of Turin, and that reminded you of a poem about, you know, telling Christ's crucifixion story from the perspective of the cross, and that, you know, this led you to think what would happen if the body that, you know, came back was not Christ. And like, I'm very curious about kind of like the genesis of certain ideas, and, you know, for a character like this, like how fully formed was that idea, or was it just a vague notion and you're like, what would happen to that, and you start kind of playing around with that in draft?
Yeah, exactly. So it was back, the original idea, the genesis is probably from my university days. I published my first book, Please, just when I was kind of finishing university. But around the same time, I was taking an old English course, maybe middle English and old English. I can't remember the exact kind of parameters of it. But we studied a poem called The Dream of the Rood, which is kind of what I kick off the book with, a little excerpt from that poem. And it's a poem that stuck with me ever since. And it was such a stunning poem. Like there was a lot of the old English poetry did not resonate with me. It was, you know, very, very challenging to read and read in translation and so on. But this one really did stick with me. And it's a poem of Christ's crucifixion told from the perspective of the cross. So the rood and the cross sort of meditating on what an incredible honor it is to bear this, you know, one of a kind, important person in human history, and you know, the incredible responsibility it has to bear the figure of Christ. And so it was just something that I always remembered. I was just like, wow, like I've never read something that, you know, from that point of view before. And it was really interesting, you know, especially given all the, you know, connotations, religious connotations, and sort of the presence of Christ and the cross in our culture. And then, you know, it was years later, I can't remember now if I read something about Shroud of Turin or I saw something about it. You know, the burial shroud that Christ was purportedly wrapped in and then kind of you know, left an imprint on is basically the kind of mythology around it, of his appearance. And I just sort of, you know, started thinking, oh, like, I wonder, you know, like, it's such a relic and we're all sort of obsessed with this relic and whether or not it's true. And then I got started thinking about those relics of the Holy Cross, you know, the constantly people trying to sell them or have found a relic of the Holy Cross or whatever. And I was wondering, like, what actually did ever happen to that cross, you know, that Christ was crucified on. And then it just popped in my head, like, what if that cross was actually just the physical body? If you're thinking of, you know, Christ as a spirit, as this Holy Spirit, like, what if, like, the body didn't actually go with them? The body was just the equivalent of that rood, that cross, and was bearing that, you know, important spirit, just like that poem talked about, and then the body was left behind. And then it was a really quick leap from there to go, well, if that soul left, what happens if another soul pops in and it's not, you know, the same sort of heavenly divine soul? And so that's where the character of Cross came in. So I had the character first because I just had that idea of an immortal rogue in this holy body, and the sort of, you know, wonderful tension that creates from a storytelling perspective, right? Of you know, Cross is a drunk and a thief and a killer and an angel hunter, but he's in the body of Christ, like the holiest body of all. And so there's a wonderful tension there. And then I was just like, okay, what's the story? And then I knew, like, it had to start, like, the book starts at the Gaudi church in Barcelona, because I'm kind of obsessed with that church, and I find it, like, there's a lot of parallels there. It's a really interesting construction of kind of Christian mythology in a way that's almost alien, and certainly not typical of you know, other churches and cathedrals and that sort of thing. So it seemed like a good fit for the character of Cross, and to sort of have that as the opening setting for the book. And then I just needed, you know, what's my story? And for whatever reason, I'd been thinking about the painting, the Mona Lisa, and I've always thought that it's, I know a lot of people kind of get hung up on the character of Mona Lisa and her smile and all that, but I've always been really intrigued by, like, the weird kind of background to that character, or to that that painting, because it's to me, it just always has looked kind of apocalyptic, like a kind of almost a hellish landscape, and I don't know why, but that's just the way that it kind of resonates with me. And so all of those things just came together to, I had this character, I knew I wanted to start in that Gaudi church, and I wanted to have something to do with the weird mystery of Mona Lisa and what's happened to her, the real Mona Lisa, who in the Mona Lisa Sacrifice, my book, is actually a supernatural creature. And then I just kind of went from there.
So the Cross character, like you said, you develop this body, you come up mm-hmm. with this idea, but that doesn't necessarily give you his character, which, like, I'm very mm-hmm. curious about, like, kind of making him this person who doesn't necessarily know why he is who he is and is in pursuit of that in some sense, but sometimes kind of runs away from it. And, you know, his, there's always, you know, this notion of, like, the unreliable narrator, but, like, he's someone who's narrating, but at the same time, like, kind of points out his own unreliability.
Yeah. He's, like, the first book was particularly sort of interesting and challenging to write because he is a character who doesn't know why he exists. And, you know, I was obviously trying to get at there a little bit of our kind of state of affairs, you know, in the modern world too, right? And our relationship with religion, where we're, you know, I think we largely have an uneasy relationship with religion, and or an uncertain relationship with religion. And Even those of us who I think, you know, would like whatever faith, you know, we're looking at to be true, there's that degree of uncertainty. And because of that, there's that degree of uncertainty as to why we are here and who we are. You know, do we have a purpose, or are we just like, you know, Cross feels like a lot of the time, drifting aimlessly through time, and just trying to amuse ourselves until, you know, we finally die. And as the series goes on, he does the first book, he's certainly kind of in that existential phase of his existence. But as the series goes on, he does find a bit more meaning through his circles of friends and the kind of world that they create. So the first one, it's largely he's operating in a world that he's inherited or has been trapped in, however you want to look at it. And then the other books, it's kind of his efforts to try and save the world, but also shape the world. You know, he's be the change you want to be. Like, he's literally trying to do that. Often kind of working against his best or his own instincts, because he's also very weary and tired of existence, and sometimes just simply does want it to end, but he can't help but sort of keep saving the world time and time again. But, you know, he doesn't generally save it for the big picture kind of, you know, I have to save all of humanity. He's saving it for the handful of people that he knows and wants to see survive.
Yeah, he's not a character who necessarily takes the long view, despite, you know, living for a long, long time, right? Like, he kind of just focuses on the immediate. And as he even says at one point in the first book, you know, like, it would be great to have this planned out, but like, to even have a plan would be something beyond him at some point.
Yeah. And I think that's true of anybody who's, you know, lived for a certain amount of time. I mean, I certainly plan way less now that I'm older, because I know most of my plans don't work out anyways. Like, something always comes along and derails them. And the older I get, the more I actually try and live in the moment and be present in the moment. You know, I've been doing tons of reading on stoicism and that sort of thing. And I do my daily meditations, and I'm spending my last few years, I've been spending a lot of time just trying to be, and not plan and not catastrophize and not, you know, think too much about the future. So Cross sort of feels in some respects like he's a bit more nihilistic than me, but he's I think he's given up on planning and dreaming and all those things, because I think we all would if we'd been living since the Roman times, right? And, you know, I think we'd just be trying to just exist.
You'd mentioned that later, you know, he surrounds himself with his circle of friends. In this first book, you know, one of his friends, or at least, you know, the people in his orbit, is Alice from Alice in Wonderland. Mm. And, you know, she plays a critical role in terms of, you know, helping him. How did you come up with that idea?
Oh, she's just such an interesting character. And that character actually came to me ages ago. I'd seen it was a little piece of art, and I wish I could remember the artist, and I can't anymore, but it was somebody had done kind of a menacing illustration of Alice wearing like a top hat and having sort of the rabbit's teeth and holding an axe behind her back. And it was just, in this sort of charming body of this, you know, this little girl, this little waif, right? So it was an interesting kind of juxtaposition of different elements in that illustration. And it always kind of stuck with me. So when I was writing this book, I realized I wanted him to have like a literary character for a friend. Like somebody who's literally stepped out of a book, because it's a bit of a, these books in there, they're kind of an artistic multiverse kind of thing, right? The characters move in and out of paintings and books, and Alice can travel from sort of one realm to another through libraries, right? Through finding secret passageways in libraries and that sort of thing. And so I knew I wanted a literary character, and she's not the only literary character that appears in these books. Like Frankenstein's creature appears in the Dead Hamlets, and Jules Verne is in and some of his characters are in the Apocalypse arc. But Alice is sort of his best friend, and I couldn't tell you Like, it wasn't like I plotted it out through the series or anything like that. It was just I just had this compelling kind of vision of this character, and put her in to, you know, kind of help Cross move from point A to point B at certain points, deliver him knowledge and you know, literally move him from library to library, that kind of thing. But the more I wrote of her, the more I found her a compelling character. And she introduced this sort of note of chaos into the books that I quite enjoyed. And other people seem to enjoy too, like the amount of people who have sort of, you know, told me that Alice is like their favorite character in the books is like, you know, I feel really, really gratified. And it kind of, it's an alignment too with, I like to take characters or settings or myths or whatever I can that we all kind of have an awareness of or a context, you know, something that's like a cultural touchstone for us already, and just kind of reformat it for this, for these books and this series, and give it kind of a new life. I'm a big believer in that idea of the book you write being a conversation with other books, or, you know, literature in general, however you want to sort of frame it. And so sometimes taking these characters and kind of reinventing them as part of that conversation for me, or giving them backstories that they may not have, or, you know, things like that. So, yeah, she's another one who just kind of grabbed me and wouldn't let me go.
It's also a conversation with the visual art world too, that like there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, and I'm not a painter or a visual artist of you know, any means whatsoever. But I, you know, there are paintings that have captivated me over time, just like any of us, I imagine. And in the Mona Lisa Sacrifice, there's a painting Hadley's Castle that I saw, you know, years and years and years ago, and it's just always stuck with me. It's a very, very simple painting. You know, sort of ruins in a English landscape. But it was one of those ones that stuck with me so long that I went, I'm going to put this in the book, and my characters are actually going to go there and, you know, through this sort of magical portal and get stuck inside of this painting. And that's, you know, becomes one of like the plot points. And it's not the only painting they travel into, but I can't say too much more because of spoilers. But, you know, I think of these books largely as sort of my love letter to literature and to arts and, you know, reading, and it's mainly sort of a love letter to books, but I've definitely thrown in, you know, a few paintings and theater, particularly in The Dead Hamlets, the second book, because I did have a theater background, so there's a lot of theater in there as well.
Going back to Alice, you mentioned Alberto Manguel in the book. Was Into the Looking Glass Wood a book that you had read like around the time you were working on this? Like, because obviously he writes about Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland.
No, it was just one of those things. I was just, what I like to do is I try and drop in sort of either cultural references or storylines that I don't actually pursue. Because I like the idea of the reader kind of creating a parallel story or a backstory or a side story on their own, and sort of letting their imagination run wild. So I kind of like to drop things in and then kind of deliberately don't follow them up sometimes, because I just like the hint of the story, or I like the you know, there's an allusion to something that kind of evokes a certain mood or feel, or an era, like whatever it is, but I don't actually feel the need to follow up on that, and it would probably be distracting if I did follow up on it, but it's sort of a nice tease for the reader's imagination, and so that, yeah, so that there's a lot of that kind of thing in there. I'll in throughout all the books I'll drop a reference to something and then kind of trust that the reader's going to create their own story with it.
Speaking of imagination, obviously you're borrowing from history and mythology, but kind of repurposing it for this, you know, universe in which Cross exists. Like, how daunting was it to kind of take something like that and repurpose it? Or was it like really kind of liberating to kind of smash through some of these things?
Both. it's, you know, you have to be careful, obviously. Like Alice is a great character to do that with, because if you do what I did and create a kind of chaotic Alice, who is really unpredictable and uncertain, nobody's really going to complain, because that's kind of the spirit of those books anyways. And you know, I was obviously trying to write, I wasn't totally reinventing Alice. I was writing sort of a, you know, variation on I think what those, the spirit of those books is anyways. There's a certain, you know, you want to get it right at the same time. So like the book that's coming out in 2026 sort of gets into a lot of Alice's backstory and creation, the sort of, you know, historical creation as a character and as, you know, the series of books that Lewis Carroll wrote. So I had to do a lot of research on that just to make sure I was getting the details I was dropping in that book correct. And there wouldn't be anything that would like throw people out. And so it was quite detailed research in terms of like, I was looking at like, you know, what's the furniture in this actual room, you know, and things like that. And it's the same thing I did in the Mona Lisa Sacrifice. So there's a, you know, section of the book that, that takes place during the Depression years, in, you know, in the American Depression, which I obviously didn't have much experience with. So I went and got some books when I was starting to outline that book, and read a bunch of books about the American Depression just to make sure I was getting those details correct enough that, you know, that it would hold up in that book. So sometimes I'm just kind of taking the idea and running with it, and sort of taking all the inherited you know, cultural context and cultural references that I know people are going to bring to it, and having some fun by kind of reinventing that. But then other times I'm like, no, I need to make sure I actually get this right, because it won't work if I'm getting a historical detail wrong and people know it's wrong. And so then I do my research. So it's, yeah, it's really like a mix, and trying to find the right line, you know, tight rope to walk, and hope I do it.
Is the research process like a pretty significant chunk of this? Because, you know, like, particularly like when you bounce around in eras, or you're, you know, spanning large swaths of history, you're, you know, talking about Camelot and Morgan Le Fay and Fairy and like the Legion of Angels, and like there's just a lot going on. How do you kind of winnow down or like focus your energies when it comes to research? Because it feels like you could have spent a long time reading a lot of different things.
Yeah, and you don't want to read too much, because you spend all your time reading too much, and you can kind of research your way out of a story, if you know what I mean. Like, you can get so bogged down in, is this historically accurate, that you lose the thread of the, you know, the story you're trying to tell, right? The imaginative act. and so I tend to do the research for the stuff that I'm like, no, I've got to get like the historical setting of this right. Like, I wanted to make sure I got like the Depression right, because that was a backdrop that it's very important to me that the character of Cross and these angels and all that aren't seen as some sort of alternative world. Like, to me, this is very important that it's kind of an urban fantasy or supernatural thriller, whatever the genre you want to call it, but that it's our world, right? I wanted to sort of transform our world into something magical. And so we can kind of see, like, you know, this kind of magic is potentially being present in our world. Like, you know, the angels could be out there. We just haven't met them yet. And there could be magic books, and Alice could be, you know, in your local library branch and all that kind of stuff. So I want to make sure that I get all of those historical details correct, or as correct as I'm, you know, I'm capable of managing. The you know, Arthur and Camelot, I wasn't too worried about that, because our sort of sense of it is mainly as a myth anyways. So I just kind of wanted to do a spin on that myth. But again, like I was saying about the new book with, you know, all the Alice stuff in it, there's, you know, a bunch of stuff about Lewis Carroll in it, because it's about you know, genesis of Alice and in the world and the Wonderland books. So I wanted to make sure I got that right, because I don't want people to think this is just some parallel world or something like this. I really want them to sort of think, yeah, like I want them to go to, you know, where Lewis Carroll wrote and kind of connect that with the story that I've written, rather than seeing it as two completely different realms, if that makes sense.
Maybe there's like a time for exploring things and there's a time for exploding things and deciding which is which.
Yes, exactly. I like that. Yeah, I'm going to use that.
You're welcome to it. So when you kind of return to these stories, like, do you have like a through line in terms of like, so Cross, you know, as like your fixed point, but like Judas is his kind of like antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you build that up, like how important is the, like the person he's fighting against as opposed to your central character? Like, do you feel like you have to kind of do Judas justice in some sense?
Yes. And that's a great question. Cause Judas is a mystery, to him somewhat as well. And I'd plan to, explore the character of Judas more in future books and kind of, sort of tell more of their story. The first book, I mean, the Mona Lisa Sacrifice is really about Cross trying to figure out himself. So he needs to, have his foil, you know, the character to bounce off of in terms of Judas, because Judas is the one who's constantly thwarting him and taking away everything he loves and trying to keep humanity mired in, you know, the blood and muck, as he puts it. But it, you know, at the heart of the book, it's a story of Cross trying to overcome the mystery of his own existence. And Judas is simply like the, you know, the obstacle or the vehicle to understanding that. However, you know, he looks at it sort of different ways throughout the book. But it's really about Cross. Now, as the series goes on, that changes somewhat. And, you know, the Dead Hamlets is really sort of a race against time. It's not Cross trying to figure out his existence. It's Cross trying to save his daughter, from being, killed by this ghost and that's haunting these fairy productions of Shakespeare's plays. So the second book is very, very different in that it's a race against time. It's not sort of a, kind of metaphysical, you know, mystery in the same way that like Mona Lisa Sacrifice, maybe. It's a real, much more of a kind of a thriller, although it's got, you know, very, very rooted in the theater world. And the third book, The Apocalypse Arc, is similar. It's Cross trying to, trying to save the world, but also trying to make amends for his past, because the world is in danger of ending. And the premise of that book is Noah's Ark is trying to end the world, because in these books he's not the sort of savior of humanity, but he's God's jailer. So all of God's mistakes basically wind up on the Ark, which is like a prison ark. And Noah's gone mad, sort of looking after all these monstrosities over the ages. Now he wants to end the world, and Cross is the only one who can stop him. But the way that he's going to end the world is by raising this sunken city with this kind of Lovecraftian creature in it. And Cross has inadvertently given him the means to do that in the past. And so that book, he's trying to very much make amends for mistakes he's done in the past. So he's much more sort of self-aware, I think, in a way that he's nowhere near that self-aware in the first book.
Well, that one definitely sounds like the exploding side of the exploring versus exploding.
There's lots of exploding tentacles.
Well, the Mona Lisa Sacrifice, book one in the Cross series out through Poplar. Peter, thank you very much for taking some time to talk about it, and congratulations on its re-release.
Oh, thanks very much.